Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. In late 2017, Zenith Energy stole into Portland in the dead of night and took over an abandoned petroleum facility, proceeding to turn it into the largest oil-by-rail facility in the Northwest. The community rose up in fury that a fossil fuel facility of this size could operate in Portland after the city passed an ordinance the year before banning any new fossil fuel storage infrastructure or expansions of existing facilities. Despite pledges to stop Zenith, the city seemed unable or unwilling to act in any forceful way until last summer. In response to overwhelming public pressure from community members and a vast array of organizations and elected officials from around the state, Portland City Council denied Zenith a land use compatibility statement they needed in order to get a clean air permit from DEQ, and it looked like Zenith's expansion could be stopped. But on October 3rd, in a surprise move, the Bureau of Development Services, led by Commissioner Dan Ryan, granted Zenith the land use compatibility statement, allowing oil trains to continue to run through the gorge in Portland neighborhoods for at least five more years. Today, we talk with longtime labor activist and current climate activist Margaret Butler about what is really going on here. Welcome to Locus Focus, Margaret.
Thanks, Barbara. It's great to be here.
I think the last time we talked, you had just gotten off the railroad tracks in front of Zenith a few years ago.
That's right. I helped build the garden on the railroad tracks.
Let's just talk a little bit about that action, because I think that sort of sets the tone for what might be ahead of us.
Yeah, it does. We launched the Extinction Rebellion chapter here in Portland on Easter Sunday 2019 by bringing a dump truck load of topsoil and a tiny house and building a garden on the tracks, right next to the tracks.
And this is almost a year and a half after Zenith came to town.
That's right. And it's right after the news broke that they were expanding capacity from 12 oil train cars at a time to 44.
And one other thing, they were bringing tar sands oil, too.
Right. They were bringing tar sands oil in at that time. And so we built this garden. We actually didn't get arrested until 4 p.m. on Monday, so we were there overnight. And a lot of people in Portland brought plants to put in the garden, and our demand was rezone the whole thing. We're in a climate emergency. We can't have 90% of Oregon's fossil fuels between Forest Park and the river. It doesn't make sense, and we've got to get off fossil fuels as quickly as we can.
Let's talk a little bit about this expanse of tank farms that Zenith is part of, because this is something that I think most Portlanders have kind of taken for granted as long as any of us have lived here. For me, it's like 51 years, and it wasn't until very recently that I actually understood what was in there. So what is in there, and why shouldn't it be there?
Well, 90% of Oregon's fuel is stored there, and it's on a liquefaction zone, which means in the event of a subduction zone earthquake, many of the tanks, a lot of them are very old, would burst. We would have a deep water horizon style emergency. And we're overdue for that earthquake.
I understand that when people went down to Zenith, because it was the cause du jour, that they realized there was something else going on there besides Zenith. And actually, we're going to get into that in a couple of weeks when I air my new documentary, which is about all the things that are going on along the river in the north reach of the Willamette that shouldn't be going on there. But I wanted to get a sense from you about what was your first response when you went down to Zenith to spend the night there. What really stood out in your mind?
The smell, the toxic poison, the trucks going past all the time, very fast on Front Avenue. And I saw an osprey. I remember seeing an osprey down on the cement, and I was like, go away, go away. But it blocks, that whole area blocks the access from Forest Park to the river, which was a thriving natural place. And you can only imagine what it was like before this. It's a travesty that it's there.
Actually, about a year ago, I was with Bob Salinger with Portland Audubon doing an interview at Terminal 2, which has been this abandoned terminal that belongs to the Port of Portland and has been empty for years and years. And we were doing this interview, and suddenly we heard this sound. And Bob, who's a bird genius, went, it's an osprey. And then we looked for it, and it was on this crane. Uh-huh. And it was on the arm of the crane. He pointed out to me. And it's one of those things where it makes you feel, it kind of reminds me of being with Indigenous people.
Right.
That like the Indigenous people who have hung on here and are asserting themselves.
Right.
And actually, I think, doing some of the best work to reclaim life as it should be.
Yes.
Along the Willamette River. So are the ospreys and the peregrine falcons and the bald eagles and all the other wildlife that lives there.
Yeah. Yeah.
After you were arrested, and actually you were arrested twice.
Right.
Were you one of the two?
Yes.
Yes, you were, because I went to your trial. And you got off.
Right. Well, we pled not guilty by reason of necessity to the second charge of criminal trespass, and a Multnomah County jury, 5 out of 6 people, voted to acquit us, which was kind of a landmark thing in the use of the necessity defense in climate cases. We really convinced that jury, that judge, and everybody in the courtroom that we had tried everything else, and now's the time to do peaceful civil disobedience, because there is really nothing else that's going to move the needle, has any chance of really of moving the needle. And I have to say, after going through the renewal of the terminal zoning amendments this summer and realizing that, you know, they passed in 2016, which you said in the introduction, that no new fossil fuel infrastructure, no expansion. The city got sued. They passed it again in 2019, and they passed it again this summer, and they're being sued again. And it hasn't gone into effect. You know, so what else is left if we can claim this big victory of having passed this policy and then it never goes into effect?
I've had this very strange experience with people I work with up in Washington State. And I know Eric DePlace with Sightline Institute has been on the show a lot. And he always, we talk about Portland as being the shining light of really stopping future fossil fuel expansion. The people in Tacoma that have been fighting this massive LNG tank that and whole facility in the port of Tacoma, which got built illegally and then got all its permits. And they would point to Portland as doing it right. And I have to say, well, at first, I didn't have to say, but after a while, I began to realize, no, Portland has not even succeeded in getting this in place. And then when Zenith came to town, I think it became really obvious of the challenges. Now, after you were arrested in April of 2019, then there was a series of community forums.
Right.
I want to talk a little bit about that, culminating with this massive gathering at University of Portland that summer.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, all the groups really cooperated to do a lot of community education, and we're starting another round of that, by the way, but there were 5 forums, and then the University of Portland, which was actually a city council hearing that was packed. The room was full, standing room only, and it was all people wanting to speak out against this transshipment of oil from Portland, which shouldn't exist. The other city policy that passed in 2015 was a resolution saying no oil trains in Portland neighborhoods. So Zenith totally goes against everything the city has put out there that they believe to be the right thing.
Well, I remember talking to somebody from Joanne Harnesty's office when you guys were on the railroad tracks and trying to get a sense of, why can't you be more urgent? Why can't you stop this? And he started going on about how the city would be sued and we wouldn't have money for parks.
Right.
And there's probably some truth that the city would be sued.
Right.
But I was wondering, as someone who was sitting on the tracks at that moment, how did you feel about the fact that the city was more worried about having lawsuits than they were about having climate chaos?
Right. No, it's as if, well, we hadn't got the city to do the climate emergency declaration yet, but it's all words. It's all words unless you take some hard actions and risks. And life itself is worth taking a few risks for.
I will say that to Commissioner Hardesty's credit, she was the only commissioner who sent anybody down.
Right.
Which says a lot. And at that time, there was at least one other strong climate advocate on city council, which is Chloe Udaly. I'm not sure why she didn't send anybody down. But I think that though the rest of the city council likes to think of themselves as climate champions, going back to Charlie Hales, we'll get to that in a few minutes, back our mayor before Ted Wheeler, who pronounced himself, I remember he was at some international gathering where he was promoting how Portland was his climate leader at the same time that Portland, he had signed this kind of, or was about to sign this closet deal with Pembina, who you might remember from Jordan Cove, who was going to build the largest propane rail terminal in Portland, I guess the largest one in the world or in the nation or whatever. And so there was this contradiction. Well, just as a teaser, we'll get into more what happened with that. But there's these all these cases where Portland City Council and mayors like speak one thing and do another thing.
Yes, yes. In this case, it's really, really very blatant, because the lawyers from several of the allied groups that worked with the city all through this process were expecting and had been told that they would get to see and know about what was going on. And then the city surprised everybody by believing Zenith's claim that they would move to 100% renewable in 5 years and using that as an excuse when Zenith has lied to the city many times.
Well, a friend of mine texted me after that announcement was made that Zenith was going to change its product and its outlook and become a good citizen of the world by producing renewable diesel. So my friend asked me, do you believe this? I said, I'll sell you the Selwood Bridge if you want. So I think that that's kind of, I keep thinking of Groucho Marx's jokes about that, or the swampland in Florida, which is worth a lot of money now. But I think that there's a frustration that people are feeling with not being able to get a straight answer from the city. I think we should, before we go more into our emotional outbursts, we should talk about what Dan Ryan did. I want to start out with a quote from Dan Ryan. This was in August of 2021, right after the city denied the land use compatibility statement for Zenith. And Commissioner Ryan said, "It is time to stop kicking our declarations down the road of intention and start acting with the urgency needed at this critical time in history."
And we want to ask Dan Ryan, what changed? It's even more critical every day. The news is worse.
I wonder, have you got any inside words about what's been going on in Commissioner Ryan's office?
I have not gotten any inside words on that. It looks to me like he has always been very friendly to business, and I'm sure that there was a lot of behind-the-scenes encouragement.
There's also some interesting timing about this, because what happened shortly after the announcement was made about the Lux being approved?
2 days afterwards, the Oregon Supreme Court put out a notice that they would not hear the case that had been appealed to them about that Zenith had filed against the city appealing the denial of the Lux last August. So that would have meant we'd be talking about how do we get Zenith shut down now that it's gone to the Supreme Court and really putting the pressure on shutting down operations?
It's really a big question. I mean, I guess one of the big players in this is probably that they aren't coming to the surface is the Portland Business Alliance. So let's talk a little about who they are. I mean, I used to think they were something different from the Chamber of Commerce, but they're actually the Portland Chamber of Commerce.
Right, they are.
So who are they, and what kind of pressure have they historically held over the city, particularly around fossil fuel development?
Well, they claim to be the job creators, and so that's the pressure that they use, plus all the campaign donations, favors, et cetera, that can go people's ways. And the developers, I'm sure, are very involved.
I haven't had time to do this yet, but I'm wondering if I can find historic campaign contributions for city commissioners from the last two elections. I think they're probably still available. I'm wondering if anybody has done any digging to see how much money certain commissioners have gotten from the members of the Portland Business Alliance.
Yeah, I don't know. I have not done that research either, but they certainly have been, you know, the clean energy fund, the attack on the clean energy fund. A few months ago, we did an action there where two scientists got arrested at the PBA office because they've been on the wrong side of all this, and we don't have time.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus on KBOO-CUNY Radio in Portland, Oregon, Seattle stations KBFG, LPFM, and KODX, LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with climate activist Margaret Butler about why Portland has caved in to Zenith Energy. So I wanted to talk about some of the other connected threads about the legal processes that are going on and why the timing of this is so bizarre. What I'm thinking about in particular is, I guess Portland is coming up with a new...
They're renewing the renewable fuel standard is one thing that's going on right now. And that we a bunch of us went to a question and answer session a couple of weeks ago, raised all these questions that they said, oh, that's a good question about the carbon intensity measure that they use to analyze whether a renewable fuel will actually make any difference. There are lots of questions about that measurement. It was heavily lobbied by industry in California, and the Oregon standards based on the California standard. So, and there is no, you know, solid evidence that renewables actually do reduce emissions. So hanging their hat on renewables is a really bad idea. And the Portland needs to have a really clear renewables policy and measure the outcomes and make sure it's not adding additional fuel down there in that 6 miles.
So the California standard, you're saying, was not particularly reasonable scientifically?
Well, the scientist I heard talk about this says it's all modeling. There is no real research because it's new enough and it's about the lifetime impact of all the steps in creating the biofuel. And so there are so many moving parts that it's really impossible to do anything more than a best guess as to what the impact
will be. Well, I find it very interesting to look at the players who are pushing for renewable fuels, because the big ones are the frack gas industry here in Portland, Northwest Natural, up in the Puget Sound area, Puget Sound Energy. And it's lovely players who have very bad track records in terms of honesty, like Zenith Energy, which is not a local company. I think they're based in Houston. Then also Next Energy, which is trying to do a renewable energy facility outside of Clatskanie, a port westward. And I think this is something we've talked about this on the show, and we're going to be talking a lot more about it soon, because it's the same kind of issues where this is fuzzy stuff, both at the state level and in the city level, about what renewable standards really are. So these companies, which have no track record at all in terms of doing anything environmentally sound, are saying, oh, we are now environmental. Well, it reminds me back in the day when BP, British Petroleum, and you might connect them with something called the Deepwater Horizon catastrophe. In the early 90s, I think, they called themselves Beyond Petroleum. And that lasted a couple of years. And they were going to tout solar and wind and stuff like that. So what's your thought about relying on fossil fuel companies to suddenly become players in the new renewable future?
Well, they've been lying to the public for at least 3 decades about the impact of their product on the world, about their intentions, about what they're doing. So there is no reason at all to trust any of them. And I'm hoping that DEQ, when it looks at this air quality permit, which is sort of the next step on Zenith, will remember that they fined Zenith $25,000 2 years ago because they lied completely about what they were doing and went ahead and did this construction without a permit.
So it doesn't sound very favorable towards Zenith. However, I mean, think about one of my biggest concerns about the present and the future is how much lying is becoming the norm.
Right.
And I'm not sure if Zenith's any worse a liar than Trump. It seems like it's the same thing. You say something enough and people will believe you. I wonder how to counter Zenith's lies, and Next for that matter as well, and Northwest Natural and Puget Sound Energy. How do we counter them so that people really can get a clear look at what's really going on?
I mean, I think it's organizing, you know, doing the public education, involving many, many more people, in just taking them on tours down there to see and smell and experience.
Get a headache. Every time I go down there, I get a headache.
Right, yeah.
I have a friend up in Tacoma, and he's really big on doing bicycle tours of the Port of Tacoma. And I remember I would stay with him when I was working in my last documentary that took place a lot in Tacoma. And he would be talking about this friend of his who wanted to go hiking on Mount Rainier. And he'd say, no, you need to come and hike the port. And at the time I thought, John, you're kind of crazy. But then when I started going down to our port, which I had been very divorced from, unlike the Port of Tacoma, right. which like is, the whole city surrounds the Port of Tacoma. But here, it's just tucked away.
Right.
Reminds me of the child in the basement in that story by Ursula Le Guin, Those Who Walk Away from Amelis, the child who's being tortured so that everybody else in the town can be happy.
Right.
And that's, to me, what the port is and the neighborhoods surrounding the port are to the rest of us in Portland who don't live and breathe those fumes.
Right. We call it a sacrifice zone, that all those people who have to live there and will be at ground zero if something happens, which we're overdue for.
I want to get back to like the contradictions and learning how to read the city elected officials. A few weeks ago, I'm not sure, were you there when the city passed for the umpteenth time the fossil fuel infrastructure ban? And this time it was, the whole thing I think had to do with the earthquake, because that we were trying right. to find some ways to satisfy the requirements from the Land Use Board of Appeals that it fits into safety and other parts of the city
right.
plan. So everybody is voting yes. Mingus Mapps, it's his turn to vote yes. He says, well, I want to express my deep regret that there's no carve-out for clean fossil fuel.
So, well, they carved out renewables in that zoning amendment. Yeah. I was not there, but yeah. I'm not surprised.
And actually, that. Clean fossil fuels is not even as
right.
good as renewable.
Right.
I mean, what it is, it's a euphemism for frack gas.
Right.
And I thought, I mean, like watching that, and I have it recorded, so I can play it back from Mingus Mapps just to let him see what he said then. But I think that that's kind of duplicity that we're getting from our city councilmen. And there was a time, and when the first fossil fuel infrastructure ban was passed in, well, it was first kind of, the hearings were in 2015.
Right, 2016.
And then, yes. Well, 2015, I think, was the hearings, and then 2016 was when the vote happened,
right,
right after Trump was elected, actually.
Right. Very December.
Yeah. And there was mostly unanimousness among the city councilmen. I remember Steve Novick and Nick Fish both had their little quibbles. And Steve Novick's, being typical Steve Novick, was, it's not left enough. It's not progressive enough. And I don't remember what Nick Fish's were. And it's disturbing to see how these politicians have to like play out their own little vested interests and their egos. This time around, the only person who really did that on council was Mingus Mapps. But I have a sense that this council is even less reliable than it was 4 years ago.
Yeah, and I'm not the person who's followed the city as much as other people in Extinction Rebellion, but I do think that they're much more, at least three of them are much more in the pocket of the business community than in past councils.
It does appear that way. And actually, one of them who's in the pocket of the business community defeated Chloe Udaly, who was the arch enemy of the business community.
Right.
So I think we're seeing the council move more to the right, and I think there's a lot of concerns that it may move even more to the right unless people get out and organize in
right.
the next few weeks. So I think you really need to go and look at the track record of all our city commissioners and read the voters' pamphlet really carefully when it comes, because there's the future of the city
right.
really hinges on getting the right people elected.
Right. And look closely at the charter review proposal
right.
as well.
I've done three shows on that now.
Okay.
I'm very excited by that.
Yeah.
Well, I wanted to talk a little bit about the response that you were brewing to this, because mm-hmm. at first when we heard about it, I think there was a certain sense of helplessness that like, how could this happen?
Right.
And how did and the deceitfulness with which it happened. But it seems like there's a lot more energy brewing now. So I wanted to talk about some of the plans that you have.
Right. There, actually, we had sort of launched a new coalition effort around Zenith before this happened. We had already had Extinction Rebellion invited a bunch of allies to come and talk to us about what they were doing around Zenith, and it turned into a new little coalition to do education and look at strategies around dealing with Zenith and the CEI hub. And so that had already been in the works, and we have a webinar coming up on Thursday, October 13th, and if you go to the Extinction Rebellion Portland website or to Columbia Riverkeeper or to 350. You can register for that webinar. We have five speakers talking about all the details of Zenith and the CEI hub and why we really need to get Zenith shut down and deal sometime over the next period of time in that with that concentration of fuels in the CEI hub.
And I'll put a link on the Locus Focus website so where people can find the link to register for the webinar.
Okay, great. And then we're also really encouraging people right now to write or call Leah Felden at the DEQ, and her email address is Felden, F-E-L-D-O-N, dot Leah, L-E-A-H, at deq.state.or.us. And, just encourage her to deny that air quality permit for Zenith. And then, of course, we're also asking people to call Mayor Wheeler and Dan Ryan and tell them this was the wrong decision. It needs to get revisited and overturned. And I understand that some of the lawyers in the affiliated groups are really looking at whether there's any possibility of a legal strategy there as well.
And if you haven't been able to write down all those web addresses and email addresses while Margaret was talking, we'll put those on the website as well so you know who to reach out to.
Right. And then we're looking at doing some public actions as well, both at the city and at Zenith, but we don't have any concrete plans we can announce right now.
Well, we could talk a little bit about what happened 8 years ago when Pembina tried to bring a liquid propane terminal to Portland. And it was a similar kind of thing where Charlie Hales, who was the mayor then, and I think it was another city commissioner, I'm not sure if it was Dan Saltzman or who it was. I shouldn't defile anybody's name. So I know that Charlie Hales was involved with the Port of Portland, which actually was a very different entity then than it is now. Because the Port of Portland, we have to give them some credit. This is coming from Bob Salinger, who should know, who's been dealing with them for 30 years. But they are actually starting to re-look at the way that the port should be structured and what to do with some of their land. But back in those days, it was this closed boys club. And word got out. I remember I was actually doing this show with Eric DePlace from Sightline. And just before I came, or maybe even while I was on, I checked my email, and there was this whole thing about Pembina. And Eric was like, he was up in Seattle, and we're basically trying to figure out what's going on with this. Because it was really the surprise. And I think it was announced in the Oregonian, some page in the back. And this became a huge movement. And in fact, I interviewed Charlie Hales about a year afterwards, and he said that there were more people in Portland who agreed that Pembina should not come to Portland than agreed on the color of the sky. And Charlie Hales at that point was like acting like, oh, I did the right thing. And I mean, but it's interesting to watch how he was pushed to do the right thing. I want to talk a little bit about some of the techniques that were used.
Yeah, well, I wasn't there, so I've just heard that his words were put with his face and there was a lot of public shaming going on. And I have to say, those kinds of tactics are being talked about.
Well, Dan Sears told me when I was doing a documentary, actually, that included that period of history, and he said that there were posters that popped up all over town. And this is while Charlie Hales was back east at this conference touting Portland as a green city. And he said, Fossil Fuel Charlie, and I guess there were other ones that went Choo Choo Charlie. So I think that it's important to look at those models because, I mean, on the one hand, when people physically attack elected officials or threaten them, as happened with Ted Wheeler, actually, I mean, there were some really nasty people outside his apartment building, which forced him to move. They weren't just harassing Ted Wheeler. They were harassing everybody who lived in this apartment building in the Pearl. And to me, that is really...
It's totally
wrong, and it's also totally destructive and does not help move our process forward.
No.
So I wonder, when you talk about shaming, what you're thinking. I mean, not the specific details, but what does that mean?
It means just telling the truth about the difference between what they say and what they actually do. And what they've done here is allow five more years of fossil fuel transshipment and all this fossil fuel that doesn't have to be coming through Portland. And anyway, that's ridiculous, and it needs to get called out.
Oh, you're listening to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with climate activist Margaret Butler, and she was one of the Zenith Five, right?
Right.
And we're talking about why Portland has caved into Zenith Energy and what can be done about it. I wanted to talk a little bit more about the CEI Hub, because I think that that's something that's just getting on people's radar. Now, you spent a couple nights down there getting headaches and feeling
right.
terrible and getting arrested on top of that. But what did you learn at the time that you spent there on the Zenith tracks?
What did I learn about the Hub?
Well, I guess about the Hub and also about the relationship between this kind of industry and the rest of the city.
Yeah, it's completely separate, and it's a place that's so removed from most people's experience of the city. I hike in Forest Park every week, and, you know, you barely notice that it's there. But when you go down there, there's this, we call it Mordor, you know, this hell place right between the park and the river. And I certainly, it was an eye-opening experience to me, who hadn't been down there very much. I knew vaguely there were tank farms down on front, but that's really, I hadn't spent no time down there before our arrest.
I had an interesting experience. It was around that time where I was driving out to barbecue out on a moorage right across from Sylvie Island, and I was taking a friend of the people who were having the barbecue in my car. And this guy, he's an amazing guy. And he has, I mean, he used to have a sound company, and then he became like a photo archivist, and he's got the most amazing archives of a lot of stuff of the Port of Portland and a lot of stuff of the Port of Tacoma. So we're driving by, and he starts naming every company that's represented right. by these tank farms. And he was driving my partner crazy, and he's rattling on and on. And I was thinking, how does he know all this? And part of me wanted to not listen. Part of me wanted to not know about this, because I was at that time spending a lot of time in Tacoma, wanting to think, Tacoma, bad, Portland, good. And I thought, this is really astonishing. And a couple of years later, when I started with Zenith, you know, getting more involved in learning what's really going on there, what he had told me really helped the lay right. of the land. One of the things that really struck me is we went by this blue tank that's right by the St. John's Bridge. I'd never thought about what it was.
Uh-huh.
And then I found out that's LNG.
Right.
And I learned about that Portland had an LNG facility when I was up in Tacoma, because my friends in Tacoma had uh-huh. figured that out. And so I was realizing this is the LNG facility that they're talking about. And Portland, you know, that, I mean, they were building the tank in Tacoma still at that time, but I thought, this is great. We got this large tank. And I know what the blast zone is for Tacoma. I wonder what the blast zone is for Portland. So I think these are things that we really need to be talking about.
Right.
When you talk to people, what kind of response do you get when you start telling these really scary stories?
Oh, they get really worried. Of course they do, especially my friends who live in St. John's. But one of the things we haven't talked about is the report that the county commissioned last year. And when I read it, the thing that leaped out to me was that Zenith is the place where that has 72 tanks that nobody knows what's in them. So they're missing specific location details, tank age, tank contents, and tank capacity information. So they were excluded from the analysis that was done because Zenith hasn't told anybody what's in it. And then at the very end of the report, in the geologist's portion of it, they said Zenith's total tanks are 86.
86?
So 72 out of 86 tanks at Zenith, we don't know.
Let's talk about that report, exactly what it was about and what it revealed.
Yeah, it was a report commissioned by the county and the city, and Eco Northwest did a deep dive into what exactly is in the CEI Hub and what would happen with severe subduction zone earthquake. And it went through all the details of which tanks would rupture based on their age. And there are many, many old tanks that would just rupture, and how much fuel based on how much information they could get, it doesn't include 72 tanks at Zenith, would actually go in the river, how it would go through the dirt and area, and how long cleanup would take, how much it would cost, how many people would be impacted. And the conclusion was that we're looking at a Fukushima or Deepwater Horizon size disaster, and that it would take many, many years to get the water clean after that disaster.
Well, I'm just going to give a little preview of what's in my documentary, because I talked to this guy, Jack Kerfoot, who's an engineer, and he's also really concerned about the LNG tank. But he did a really great description of all the disaster. And it ranges from destroying all the farms in Soviet Island, and then you can just kind of extrapolate from that, polluting the river all the way to the ocean, killing all life in the ocean. And then, of course, all these other catastrophic things would happen. And that it's also kind of this cascading catastrophe, because one tank ruptures and then it triggers another one, and there's going to be explosions and fires. And what exactly happens depends on what time of year it is. So if you want to limit the fire, I mean, one of the worst-case scenarios is Forest Park completely going up in flames. Well, that probably wouldn't happen in the winter. But in the winter, because the river's higher, it's going to carry much more of a pollution load out to the ocean. So trade-off, you want to burn out Forest Park. You want to really, really destroy the Columbia River. And the other thing that is really concerning and should get other people in Washington upset, it's not just an Oregon problem.
Right.
It's a regional
problem.
Columbia
River, yeah. Yeah. And our friends who work with the neighborhood emergency teams say the fire departments have told them that there would be nobody to fight fires anywhere else in Portland, because everybody, all emergency responders, would be dealing with the CEI hub.
If they can get there.
If
the other part, because
there.
The other part of it is the access. There's one road, basically. And then I've talked to people who live in the hills up above Linton. And I think there's like two roads that go over the hills, over the Tualatin Mountains. And one is Newberry Road. And the other one, I think, is, I'm not sure it's even paved. So people are going to be like on foot going over the hills, you know, with carrying whatever they can on their back.
Yeah.
I mean, and there's a lot of older people that live there and people who aren't real physically able. So that's really disconcerting. And they've basically been told they're going to be on their own to get out of there. And they're also told to shelter in place, depending on what the issue is. If it's a fire, obviously you don't shelter in place. If it's a big gas emissions, then you can shelter in place, sort of. But one person that I talked to from my show talked about how a woman who was involved, maybe the head of the FEMA here in Portland, told her that she wakes up every night worrying about people in Linton, and she really thinks that they should all move away from Linton and that the whole area should be turned into a industrial zone. And that's one way of thinking about it. But, of course, I think that shows the Portland Business Alliance mentality. So I just wanted to get your response to that.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I just think that's ridiculous, because the danger is going to impact our whole community. And having the people who live closest to the danger is not going to change those facts. It's only figuring out some other way, getting off fossil fuel and figuring out some other way to store the fuel that we need that's not concentrated in one 6-mile stretch between the most beautiful park in the area and the river. I mean, it's still where we started, the most ridiculous thing.
And that sort of reminds me of this whole contradiction about Portland seeing itself as this green city. And for a lot of people, we kind of promote ourselves as being the epitome of a green city. Our green city is up in Forest Park, but people are not looking at how vulnerable Forest Park is, not to mention the Columbia River, too, and the Willamette River, but to this behemoth fossil fuel industry that we've allowed to conglomerate down on the right by the river.
Right.
And let's talk about how close those tanks are to the river.
Yeah, they're very close. And I was looking at the report again this morning, and McCall Oil, which is right across from Zenith, they actually brought in filled in land from the river in the 60s and built tanks there, which it was the river before they set up that operation.
Well, yeah, actually, and those are one of the newer tanks. Some of these tanks go back to the 30s.
Oh, yeah.
And before we knew that Portland was in a seismic zone. But the other part of it is, I mean, all of the tanks are in a liquefaction zone. And that area before it was an industrial site, was basically a wetland. And there are three big lakes, right. Giles Lake, which is the one that the name is still up. When I first came to Portland, I'd see these signs for Giles Lake and go, where's the lake?
Right.
Well, the lake was, what they did is they dredged the main channel of the Willamette, where Swan Island is. Like the between Swan Island and the east side used to be the main channel. So they dredged the other channel, which was basically like a very braided river with lots of little islands and things. And they took all the dredge from that and they filled in the other side. Now what was left over, they filled in Giles Lake.
Right, right. And I think they took dirt from the West Hills as well.
Yeah, I think whenever they were building tunnels or building freeways, they take all that fill and put it in. And the thought, I mean, this is not unique to Portland, actually.
Right.
In fact, I was at some panel when they were saying that Portland is the only place that has all of its tanks on a liquefaction zone. Well, the Port of Tacoma does, too. It's even worse because it's a tide flat.
Oh, my goodness.
It's really scary what's going to happen there. And in Seattle, all ports, San Francisco Airport is built on fill. So this is what we do to our wetlands.
Yeah. No.
So I think a lot of people are thinking about, you know, when we try to think about the future, instead of thinking about an apocalypse, thinking about how do we reclaim this beautiful river to be beautiful again.
Right.
Is that something that Extinction Rebellion is talking about?
Yeah. The last time we were out at Zenith was June 4th, and the theme of our action was doom or bloom. And we choose bloom, but getting there is harder, and we need many, many more people to understand and get involved in this. But together, we could change this.
Well, one of the big issues about dealing with this is that there's this codification of land use laws that basically establish what's called an industrial sanctuary, which people who live there call it an industrial sacrifice zone, and that make it really, really hard to do anything to renature the stretch of the river, not to mention just cleaning it up.
Right.
And it's because the business associations have so much clout. So it seems that one of the first things that we have to do is understand land use laws.
Right, and the economic opportunity analysis that the city is supposed to be doing right now. And Sarah Taylor from Braided River has been very involved in trying to figure out how to intervene in that process. But we have to get the city and decision makers away from this idea that those kinds of jobs are the only kinds of jobs, and that because there aren't really that many jobs down there in that zone, and that other kinds of use and other kinds of jobs would be better for everything. And we need to listen to the indigenous people and try and do as much restoration as we can. I think the tribes have a critical role. And when Dan Ryan announced last August, said that he was going to do this, he said it was input from the tribes was a key thing in the decision to deny the Lux originally. So what happened to your input from the tribes?
Well, we should be thinking of that, especially today since it's Indigenous Peoples Day, which it's a nice thing that we had that as a federal holiday now. But I think we need to really act on what that means and to listen to these people.
Right.
And you're listening to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, Seattle stations KBFG up here from KODX up PFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with climate activist Margaret Butler about why Portland has caved into Zenith Energy and what we can do to turn the whole thing around. I'm kind of wanting to talk for the last part of the show about some of the, I know you don't want to give me specifics, but kind of generalities of the ways that you want to both reach community people and reach city council and then reach DEQ.
Yeah. Well, I would say that in terms of reaching community people, starting with this webinar on Thursday at 6:30, we're doing a series, one a month, of community forums. Hopefully the November, December, and January ones will be in person in different parts of the city. We're also going to do a flash mob and have that happen at some farmers markets and other places. We're also going to be leafleting and encouraging everybody to make the calls to DEQ and the city right now. And then, like I said, we're going to be planning some actions as well. And for us at Extinction Rebellion, we think that we need a mass civil disobedience movement, peaceful, nonviolent, direct action, like we did when we built the garden at the railroad tracks. And we're building towards that by encouraging folks who care about this to find some friends and create an affinity group and get ready to do direct action. Because to me, the way this all turns around, the way we build enough power to take on the city that's in the pockets of the business community is by enough people being willing to shut things down peacefully and demand something different.
Now, I remember going to a climate action, I think, in 2019 in the fall, and that was when that yellow fire engine that actually used to be part of the Molalla Fire Department. It still had Molalla Fire Department on it at the time. And so this fire engine comes in, and I guess it was 4th Avenue was blocked between the park and City Hall. And it was a pretty nice action. I don't think much came in terms of civil disobedience. There had been talk about doing it, but it seemed like there weren't enough people committed to doing it then.
Yeah, what happened was that it took a really long time, and the blockade wasn't effective enough, and it was a Friday afternoon, so fewer people were downtown, and so there were people committed to doing it, but they sat there, and arrests happened.
Actually, I remember the city council the city council people were on vacation or whatever.
It was late June was that action when we tried to block. There were others, but that was the first one calling on the city to declare a climate emergency.
Well, we're so much closer to the climate emergency now. I mean, we were close to it 3 years ago, but just thinking about what's gone on in the last few weeks and thinking about Hurricane Ian and now, I guess, Julia's on the way up the East Coast. And I'm not sure what air you're breathing around Portland, but I have been breathing horrible smoke for the last few days.
Yeah.
And I was talking with Dan Sears yesterday. We were trying to figure out which fire it was.
Yeah,
I'm not sure if it's still the Oak Creek fire down near Oak Bridge. But there's so many indications that the world is on fire and it's also flooding at the same time and blowing away. And I just wonder, how do we get the Portland City Council to start to act on it? I remember at the one of the demonstrations, it was during the climate strike. This is what I was thinking, the one in September of 2019. And there was this wonderful parade around City Hall with slugs.
Right.
Because people felt back then that the city was just moving like a slug.
Right. And we've been working for the last year, I think, on a campaign we're calling ANSI, Act Now on Climate Emergency, to push the city for real and concrete goals. And for the first time since they declared the emergency, they put out a climate action plan the same day they did the terminal zoning amendments renewal. But it's inadequate still and has too much sort of greenwashing things in it. And so that's a continued push as well. But I think it really is about building the numbers of people who see what's going on and are willing to take action. And I do think more people around the globe understand what's going on because they are living it. We are all living it. And I know from my work in the labor movement that things can change very quickly, and you can't always see what's going on when you look around and you say, oh, it's the same 200 people here year after year. But the connections are being made, and the potential continues to grow.
And suddenly all these Starbucks are getting unionized.
Right,
and now
exactly.
One new season is unionized.
Right. And the Jobs with Justice dinner on Thursday night, the Amazon labor union folks came and spoke, and there were two people who worked in Amazon here in Portland who asked them questions. I mean, the young energy and organizing there. So I want to keep my labor connections and say, hey, you really have to do the climate work too.
That's another show we'll have, actually, because I was hearing about John Fetterman, who's running for senator in Pennsylvania against Dr. Oz. And he's funny. He's like a real big labor guy and really strong. He's not so great about fracking because he's really concerned about jobs. And it seems like there's a lot of people in the labor movement now who are recognizing that the climate is a labor issue.
Yeah, it's starting to. The Oregon AFL-CIO had a climate summit for the first time this summer. So that's a really good thing.
So where do we go from here? I mean, I think we have to really educate people. That's the first thing. And the community meetings that you're calling, which remind me of what happened in the spring of 2019 in Portland.
They're modeled on what we did then.
And those were very effective.
Yeah.
It was interesting. I mean, that's where I first heard Sharon Myron speak, who's the county commissioner, and she really blew my mind.
Right. I remember her speaking, too. It was really, really something.
And part of me, I have this fantasy, if we could just replace the Portland City Council with the Multnomah County Commission. I had Deborah Kefouri on a few months ago, and I asked her, why was the county commission so much more functional than the Portland City Council? She says, we're all women. But I feel like, unfortunately, the Multnomah County doesn't control all the things that are really determining whether or not Portland heads barreling into a climate disaster or whether we can pull back a little bit. The county's doing what it can, but it's pretty small compared to what the city has to do.
Yeah.
And I just wonder how we get that vision into the city. Right. I mean, we talked about all this organizing models, but I'm really concerned about who is running the city right now.
Yeah.
And that may change if the Charter Commission, if the Charter Change Initiative passes. And we can we'll talk more about that in another show, because I see that as some real potential. But and that won't even happen for 2 years. I'm really worried about what's going to happen in the next 6 months.
Right. I feel like a broken record, but we really do need to reach and engage many more people if we're going to impact that. I think that the environmental community did a really good job of pressuring Dan Ryan in order to get where we got last August. But we clearly need a lot more pressure on them.
Well, it's discouraging that someone like Dan Ryan thinks he can say something like he did. Should we read that again?
Yes.
I'm going to read Dan Ryan's statement from August 29, 2021 again. He said, it is time to stop picking our declarations down the road of intention and start acting with the urgency needed at this critical time in history. Did you hear that, Dan? That was your words. So can you live up to them?
Right. You're kicking it down the road right now.
I'm going to be doing another show about so-called renewable fuels. So I know that's not your specialty, though it is one of these things that really bugs me. So we can just rant about it for a couple moments, just without any. No. But I think that again and again, we feel like we're getting really close to having a consensus about what we need to do to have true renewable energy. And then the fossil fuel industry comes back with this new, as Eric DePlace calls it, shiny new toys, like hydrogen, which is... Green hydrogen is green, but it costs way, way more to do than just to build solar panels and windmills and other things, geothermal stuff that would really work much better. And, of course, natural gas has been trying to recast itself. It's been putting its sheep's clothing over its wolf's nature, though I like wolves better than I like the fossil fuel industry. And so I feel like that's another big campaign that we need to be doing, is to really get the public to understand and not buy into the greenwashing.
Right, exactly. And all sorts of ways. I mean, I just read that the oil industry got a lot of money for carbon capture, and what they used it for was to pump more oil out. They put carbon in the oil rigs and... it was a crazy thing. They got all this funding to do carbon capture, and that's what ended up happening with it. It is an education process to get people to understand that they have a goal of making a profit, and that's what they're about, and every bit of fossil fuel that they pump out of the ground and sell is what they're about, not the climate.
Well, Margaret, it's good to talk to you. I expect to see you a lot out in the community in the next few weeks and months. And I hope that people take some of the words that you said to heart, because we all have to get involved if we're going to save not just our city, but our planet. So yeah, thanks for being on Locust Focus.
Thanks, Barbara.
We've been talking with climate activist and longtime labor activist Margaret Butler, and you've been listening to Locust Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, Seattle stations KBFG, LPFM, and KODX, LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to a podcast on our website, kboo.fm/locust-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our KBOO Public Affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KBOO staff, who are still doing an incredible job of not only keeping KBOO in the air, but helping all us volunteers make the best radio possible during this pandemic. And you can help us if you're able by becoming a member of KBOO or renewing your membership if you're already a member. We're independent, community-supported, volunteer-powered radio. Go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Or please support the community station you're listening to right now. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. I'm Barbara Bernstein. My engineer is Ray Bodwell. Next week, we'll be broadcasting my documentary about how the Jordan Cove LNG terminal and pipeline was finally defeated 9 months ago. And the following week, we will air the premiere of my new documentary, Once a Braided River. We'll go out with music by the Climate Action Chorus, written by Kate Murphy. This is one of the songs that's going to be part of the flash mob that Margaret was talking about. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, get your COVID shots, and remember to socially distance and wear a mask when necessary.
Zenith, you're a threat, making big bets. Dirty in the streets, gonna clean up your mess someday. Polluting the space, a big disgrace. Spewing your toxins all over the place. Singing, we will stop you. We will stop you. Zenith, you are done for over. Stop you in your tracks and we'll send you a bill to pay. You will be replaced without a trace. We're about to kick you out of this place. We will stop you. We will stop you. Zenith, you are old news, bold fools, grabbing all you can out of touch with the world today. It's time to embrace a safe, clean space. Until you are gone, we'll be on your trace. We will stop you.
Everybody!
We will stop you.